Jephthah. All right, Jephthah. That's who we're talking about tonight. This first point, I think, we even see nowadays, don't we? Someone who is known more for something bad, something terrible, rather than for the good that he or she may have done. I can think of brethren that fit that category, and I'm sure you can too. I think that's Jephthah's story. He couldn't help his pedigree. That's not under his control. But it was used against him, wasn't it? He's kicked out, which we'll see just in a moment. It was his bravery and his skills as a mighty warrior that finally endeared his brethren to him, and they went seeking after him for help. But what do we always remember Jephthah the most for? All right, his vow. It's his vow at the end of the chapter that we... when you say his name, that's the first thing that pops in my mind, probably yours as well, his vow that he made. And we'll talk about that some toward the end of class tonight. So let's begin by looking at a description of him. That's the first three verses. What do we learn about Jephthah from verses 1 through 3? If you just look at those first three verses, what tells us about Jephthah? All right, he's from Gilead, and as we mentioned on Sunday, starting at the middle part of chapter 10 and all the way through almost the middle part of chapter 12, the focus will be on Gilead. And again, Gilead was where? If you get the map in your mind, it's the east side of the Jordan. Typically, it refers to Gad, which is the territory on the east side. He was also called a valiant warrior. Other versions may have something slightly different. A man of valor, mighty man of valor, is sometimes the phrase that's used in the King James. And his father, his name was Gilead, but who was his mother? All right, she was an unnamed harlot. So his father begat him out of wedlock. She was not his mother. His half-brothers came to a decision. Because? Yeah, you sort of don't count. And we have no intention of doing what? Does it say? Yeah, we're not going to share the inheritance with someone who's not our full flesh and blood. You're just a product of our father's fornication with a harlot, basically is what their point was. And so you just need to get out of here. And they drove him out. Where did he go? All right, he went to the land of Tob, or Tob, however you say that. And that's sort of, if you look at a map, again, that's the very northwest corner of Gilead, right there by the Jordan River. So he never left the land, he just went into a certain section of the land that was called the land of Tob. And that's where he was, I don't want to use the word exiled, but he was driven out from his family, and he lived there. And that's really the last we hear of him until the situation's changed. They don't want him, they don't need him until he'd come in real handy to take care of whatever our situation is. So, here is the next oppressor, that's Ammon. Now, this goes back to chapter 10. Toward the last part of chapter 10, the word we used on Sunday was this vice. What was the vice that Israel found herself in? Who was oppressing her from the east? It was Ammon. Who was squeezing her from the west? That was Philistia. And so here you see, sort of looking at it on two fronts, Jephthah will take care of Ammon, and who will begin to take care of Philistia? Who's the next judge? That'll be Samson. The next four chapters are devoted to Samson, 13 through 16. But he's the next judge. No, that's not correct. I take that back. There will be three between Jephthah and Samson. But they're not given much information. That's why I overlooked them. They're like the previous two, Tola and Jer, that we talked about. So back here in these passages in chapter 10 is where we read of Ammon. We're looking at question 3 is this point. Earlier in chapter 3, when Ehud, who was the second judge, and he took care of the Moabites, but you go back in chapter 3, there was always a close tie. And for good reason, between Moab and Ammon. Why is that? They were brothers from Lot. That's right. Ammon was the descendant through the incestuous actions of Lot's younger daughter. The older daughter fathered Moab, and the younger daughter, well, I shouldn't say fathered, but gave birth to Moab, and she gave birth to Ammon. And that's where those peoples came from. So there's a connection between them two, and there's a connection to Israel, because, of course, Lot was the nephew of Abraham. So that kind of gives us an idea of how they fit into this story historically. Now, we come to the what we're calling the change of fortune for Jephthah. This is verses 5 through 11 of chapter 11. And this takes us pretty much through questions 4 and 5, bottom of page 23. The text just says in verse 4, "It came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. And it happened when the sons of Ammon fought against Israel that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah," what? What was their offer? "Yeah, you can be our captain, you can be our chief or our ruler. We need a leader." Now, what was one of the reasons why you think they went to get Jephthah? He was a mighty man of valor. They needed somebody qualified, and I'm going to put that word in quote marks. He would come in real handy for this moment. And so they offer him the job, if you will. What was Jephthah's first response? He brings up the obvious fact. Well, now, wait a minute. You were so eager to get rid of me before, now you're very eager to have me back. Leering, skeptical. Verse 7, "Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you are in trouble?" That's a logical thing to think, wouldn't it be? I mean, almost any person in that position would have had that same kind of thought. So they sort of sweeten the pot a little bit, and they say, "What? If you come back, you can be the leader. You can be the ruler. We'll make you ruler of the area." Again, we hesitate to use the word king, but ruler, leader, he would be put in a position of leadership. So he comes, and he agrees to that. And you see there in verse 10, in verse 9, he says, "If you take me back, and the Lord gives Ammon into my hand, then will I become your head?" They said, "Yes, the Lord is witness between us." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, verse 11, "and the people made him head and chief over them, and Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah." Something I didn't mention, I overlooked it, at the end of verse 3, and this gets us to the end of question 4. Something else that we were told about Jephthah. All right, some vain men or some reckless, some worthless men. Who does this sound like again? Who else did this? Well, it's the only non-judge person we've talked about. Abimelech did that. So I asked the question here at the end of question 4. Is there any indication here of the moral or spiritual state of Israel to seek out Jephthah, knowing full well who had been his associations? Didn't amount to much, but yet they're willing to do that simply because why? Well, but what did they want? Well, spoil maybe, but they wanted deliverance from oppression. And as we've made the point in the past, they seem to want that more than they want what's more important, which is what? To follow God, a relationship with God. They're more concerned about that. And they're willing even to go with a man who's had the penchant or the tendency to associate with worthless men. So again, that's just another, to me, that's another indicator of the deplorable spiritual and moral conditions of the times that we call the days of the judges. We overlooked that phrase at the end of verse 3. But that was his habit of doing that. Okay. Now, we're going to take verses 12 through 27 together, because it really all fits together. There's no way to break that up. although we'll try to put it in chunks, but there's no way to split it apart and make it talk about two separate things. We're going to call this his efforts at diplomacy. He's a mighty man of valor, but did he first try just to go out there and whip the Ammonites? No. He tried something first. He tried diplomacy first. All right. The first thing he asked the king of Ammon is what? Yes. Why are you coming out to me? What? Verse 12. What is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land? What have we done to you that you're wanting to instigate this battle? What was the king's response? All right, I've got good reason. You illegally, unlawfully, without cause, you've taken away some of our land. It belongs to us. And he says at the end of verse 13, now therefore return it peaceably. Well, now, did the Ammonite king have claim to this land? All right, he didn't win. Did Israel gain it lawfully? Of course, with whose blessing? God's. And we'll go over that. And so what I want to do is I want to look at Jephthah's response to this charge. He responds to it three different ways. And I think it's noteworthy that we see the kinds of things that Jephthah says. Let's first talk about his historical argument. And this is the longest of the three, verses 14 to 22. Basically, Jephthah just goes through the history and he tells the story, doesn't it? What does that tell you about Jephthah's knowledge? He knows. He's been taught. And see, that's the point we always want to make when we can, is that as a Hebrew, as an Israelite living in the land of Gilead, he knew those stories. But he couldn't have known them just himself because he wasn't around way back there, so he had to have been taught those things. And teaching was always so important in the family life, the history of the Israelites. And now Jephthah is going to use that knowledge to tell the story to this king. Does he get the story historically correct? He tells it right. He really does. And I've asked you here, the last part of question 6, this is the top of page 24, to go back and, if you could, find the place in the law, in the Pentateuch, where we can find those passages that corroborate what Jephthah's talking about. And so we'll do it just here in a second. All right. First thing he says is, Moses led Israel out of Egypt. And what did Moses do way back yonder? All right. Now again, who's Edom? Esau's kinfolk. And who's Moab again? Lot's kinfolk. So again, this is family. Well, as they're coming out of Egypt, Moses, they weren't going to ravage the land. They just let us pass through on their journey. What was their response? Both of them said no. So to circumvent the lands of Moab and Edom on the map, if you look at it, they then asked to go through the land of the Amorites. Now, the Amorites is the ancient land of Gilead. You look on the map, it's right there to the east of the Jordan, which is where now Gilead is. All right? And who was the king? Sihon, king of the Amorites. Not only did he deny the request, but he did something that the other two did not do. He came out to battle array. He said, well, not only am I going to say no, but we're going to fight over this. So they drew up in battle array or battle alignments, and Israel had to defend herself. And what do we learn about the battle? Well, Israel won. She defended herself and defeated Sihon, and therefore she took possession of the land. And we have all this recorded for us in Numbers chapter 20, 14 and 21, and Numbers 21, 21 through 26. This is how Israel came to possess the land. The Ammonite king is now talking about here. Yes, Brother Lambert.
When he's talking about this, he says God did these things.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not something that Israel was just doing on its own.
Right. They had the blessing of God behind all this. You're right, Brother Lambert. So that was his historical argument. Is he just told the story. But he didn't stop with that. He then says, on top of that, he gives the second argument. We're going to call this a theological argument. Notice how he argues this, verses 23 through 24. And this gets to Brother Lambert's last comment. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people, Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. It's a compelling argument here. He says, basically, we have this land simply because our God gave it to us. Now, they had to do some things to fight, yes, but he says it came from God. And to complement that, he says, and no doubt, King, you think the same thing. You're going to credit your God for giving you your land. And he did, and that's his statement. So why can't we credit our God for giving us our land? That's a compelling argument. No response from the king. That's his second argument. Then he makes one more. We're going to call this a precedent argument, 25 through 26. He brings up someone else. Balak. Now again, who was Balak? He was a Moabite king. He wasn't an Ammonite. But again, the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Amorites, if you look at one of the ancient maps in your Bible, perhaps it's all right in there together, east of the Jordan. Now what's the story real quickly of Balak? Remember what he wanted? Yeah, he called a prophet, Balaam, said, here comes this numerous people, and he knew he couldn't fight them, so he wanted Balaam to do what? I want you to curse them. And Balaam's first response was, I'm only going to say what the Lord tells me to. But Balaam was not all as honest as he let out to believe, because eventually, did he ever curse them? No, but through his counsel, we learn from the New Testament, Balaam got those wages of dishonesty, and he encouraged Balak through his counsel to get Israel to play the harlot with their gods, and that would gain God's disapproval just the same as if he did curse them. And he got what he wanted in the end. So that's Balak's story. But Jephthah's point was, Balak never made a claim on his land. You'll see that there in verse 25. Are you now any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel, or did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Orior and its villages, and all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? All this time has gone by. Surely if Balak had a claim to this land, he would have done it. And in the 300 years since him, there's never been a claim brought, Israel, you need to vacate the land, this really belongs to us. And that's again in Numbers 22, the story of Balak. No other Moabite king in the previous 300 years after Balak made such a claim to the land either. So here you have the historical argument, you have a theological argument, and now you have this argument of precedent. Three different ways he argued to this king. Basically his point is, what about your claim? You don't have one. I've answered it three different ways. You do not have a claim. You've come out to me unlawfully, wrongly, and this doesn't need to happen. You're in the wrong in this, king. Was his point through all this? Yes, the Amorites. That's correct. That's right. The Amorites were the ones. Absolutely. So he concluded, not only have I not wronged you, but he says one more thing. You've wronged me by coming out today and lining up in battle against me. That's not right. You're provoking me unlawfully. Verse 27. Now that's his effort at diplomacy. He's a mighty man. He's a fighting man. But he first tries to bring a resolution about this thing peacefully. Well, how did his words fall on the king's ears? One verse, 28. Just completely ignored what Jephthah said. The king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. Pay no attention to it. He's got his mind made up to fight. And he's gonna do that. Now, even though it doesn't say in what we've looked at so far, Whose hand is in all this? God's? Because what's God trying to do? All right, go back to chapter 10 and look at the end of the 16th verse. Israel has put away her idols, which brought about the Ammonite oppression from the east in the first place. And she repented, she put away her gods. And what did it say about God back there? All right, he could no longer endure the misery of his people crying. So he's going to deliver them. This is how God's going to choose to do it. He's going to use the efforts of Jephthah to end the Ammonite oppression. And so you see God's hand in all this. The first words of verse 29, you'll see this statement a lot with respect to Samson back in chapter 11. The Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Doesn't say mighty like it will with Samson, but it does say it came upon him. And so this is God's doing behind all this, and he's going to bring about this resolution to the Ammonite oppression. Okay, now we're up to the vow, and that really much will dominate the rest of the story. When it says that the Lord's Spirit came upon Jephthah, so that he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he went on to the sons of Ammon. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, here's his vow, verse 30 and 31. If thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So he's telling the Lord, if you grant me victory, then I'll worship you with a burnt offering. I'll offer up the first thing that comes out of my house. And that was his vow. Well, what was the victory? How did the battle go? Was it even close? Apparently not, it wasn't close. The way we see starting in the 32nd verse, Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he struck them with a very great slaughter from Aroer to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Karamin. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. So what about the Ammonite oppression at this point? It's over. Jephthah has secured victory, release from the Ammonites, and the battle is over, a great slaughter against the enemy. Was against who? Yes. Right. Because it says in the other verse, or the other chapter, that the Lord raised up Ammon. Now his hand is against them in this. And so, again, the point needs to be stated, although I think we know it's obvious, but none of this really is the doing of Jephthah. The Lord brought Ammon up, and the Lord took Ammon down. He just used the abilities of Jephthah and the Israelites defending themselves to bring that to accomplishment. Okay. Well, now this is where people really want to spend the bulk of their time in Judges chapter 11, the tragedy of the vow. The battle's over, and he made the vow. If you'll bring this apart, this about, why, I'll worship you. I'll sacrifice. So we come to verse 34. Let's read to the end of the chapter. When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, this would be Mizpah of Gilead, behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one and only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. So she said to him, my father, you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me as you have said, since the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon. And she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go to the mountains and weep because of my virginity, I and my companions. Then he said, go. So he sent her away for 2 months, and she left with her companions and wept on the mountains because of her virginity. And it came about at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did to her according to the vow which he had made, and she had no relations with a man. Thus it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to commemorate the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. Now that's where the story is right there, usually in Judges chapter 11. Let's talk about it just a little bit. When he gets home, what was first out of his house? Well, it wasn't an animal. It wasn't a sheep or a goat. Not that you'd have sheep or goats in the house anyway, but whatever he was counting on out of that house, do you get the idea that he never thought it might be a human? Well, we don't know what he was thinking, but pardon? Well, and what do we know about his daughter? Not just his only daughter, but his only child. His only child. So his daughter comes out to meet him. She's got tambourines. She's dancing. She's very euphoric, very jubilant, because her father has achieved a great victory. Somehow she knows about the victory, doesn't she? Do you get that impression? Her words at the end of verse 36. The Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the sons of Ammon. So she had some awareness of what had happened previously about her father's military victory. So she comes out of the house to greet him. When he sees her, what's the first thing he does? Tears his raiment, tears his clothes, always, of course, to a Hebrew, the sign of grief, mourning, remorse. Tears his raiment, tears his clothing, and he says, oh, my child, my daughter, you have brought me low. Well, I don't think she brought him low. I mean, she had nothing to do with this. But he realizes something about a vow. What's he know about it? Especially one made to the Lord. You can't take it back. Vows must be paid. So his daughter responded, I think, rather maturely. What does she say? Well, whatever you vow, Father, you need to keep it. You need to pay it. Again, this is her words in verse 36. Because, or since the Lord has given you this great victory, and that's what you promised, then you need to pay whatever you promised. But then she gives another condition of this. Her only request was what? All right. Do you think at this point she knows what the vow was? It doesn't say, but for her to say what she says in verse 37, it's obvious to me that she knows the gist of it. I don't know if she knows it word for word, but she knows what he's vowed. And she's asking for time. Just give me 2 months. Let me go to the mountains with my companions and let me weep or wail. Let me bemoan the fact that I'm not ever going to know the joy of marriage and having a relationship with a man to bring about children. Let me mourn that, if you will, her virginity. And Jephthah agrees to it. And then verse 39, at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and then there's the phrase, who did to her according to the vow which she had made. And we'll discuss that phrase just in a moment. But that's what verse 39 says. What do the other versions read? Something very similar? He carried out his vow. Is that the New King James? Okay. How's the Old King James, Freddie, read? Okay. All right. So it's pretty straightforward in all the versions, basically. And this resulted in an annual custom that, at least during that day, I'm not sure if it's still carried on to this day or not by those who call themselves Hebrews or Jews. I didn't look that up. But at least at the time of the writing of this book, the author tells us, they would commemorate Jephthah's daughter 4 days a year, annual custom, to commemorate her, you want to say her bravery or her maturity, her willingness to serve in that capacity. All right. Let's talk about the vow. Whether or not Jephthah actually offered his daughter as a burnt offering, that's been a long, long debated topic. Did he or did he not? Did he put her on the altar and did he offer her up in fire as he would an animal? Arguments for both, yes, he did, and here's the reasons why, or no, he didn't, and here's the reasons why. They're both made. And I've actually talked to someone who, I think this was a rather astute statement. I'm just glad that my salvation doesn't depend on if I have to know whether she did or actually not get offered. If my salvation depended on knowing that, because brethren differ on this. You get you some commentaries, commentators differ on it. So, we're not going to be able to settle that time amongst ourselves. I would suppose that even amongst us in this room tonight, we have differences of opinion. And we're not going to debate the point. We're just going to consider points, yes and no. And then you make up your own mind. Let's first consider the yes. Yes, he offered her. Well, are there compelling reasons that lead us, or that would lead one to say, yes, he offered her?
I believe he offered her.
Okay. You believe he offered her. What reasons compel you to? Okay. Verse 39 is the statement. It seems pretty straightforward when it says, he did to her according to the vow which he had made. And what was the vow specifically? I will offer whatever's out of my house first as a burnt offering. That was the vow. And so if that's what that statement means, then if you take that literally, then he offered her up in the fire as a burnt offering. Now, are there any other compelling arguments for the yes vote? I can't think of any. I'm not belittling that one. I'm just saying that's usually the main argument. Okay, wait just a second, Brother Lambert. What now? Mm-hmm. Yes. Scott's point is, if she was not offered, what would have been the point of sending her away to the mountains for 2 months to bewail her virginity if it was just, if she was offered up as a perpetual virgin and not actually offered? That's a fair question. That's a fair question.
Also the fact that they took 4 days to lament her is a pretty good indicator that, I mean, if she had not been offered, the couple wouldn't have taken that time.
Well, and David's point is, if she wasn't actually offered, then why commemorate 4 days to her memory, if you will, in this annual feast, or well, not a feast, but an annual custom? That's a good point, too. Yes, Scott? Okay. Go ahead. That was one of my points coming up. That's a good point to make, too. So, right, they weren't sinless people in Hebrews 11. Obviously, they were not. Okay, but basically that's the main argument for the yes vote, is the text says he did to her according to what was vowed. Now, what about the no vote? Do we have any no votes in here?
My yes has minus the vote.
Minus the what?
The burnt.
The burnt? Okay. Yes.
God would not accept
it. Well, okay. Human sacrifices, did they ever have God's approval? And in fact, if you look at these passages, I've got them listed here in the question, bottom of page 24. To my mistake, I neglected to put after Leviticus 18:21. I should have put Leviticus 20 in verse 2. That was even more important because if you look that passage up, God said, if the one that does this shall be put to death. Now, granted, in these passages, God is talking about offering up human sacrifices to an idol. Jephthah, if he actually did this, did it to God. But do you think God would have cared that it wasn't to an idol but to him? I can't see God saying, well, to me that's different because it's not being done to an idol, it's being done to me. I can't see God making that statement, making that argument. Also, Deuteronomy 12 and 18. Those two chapters, again, give us information about human sacrifices. So if he had offered her as a burnt offering, God wouldn't have been pleased. Like, we can say that in all honesty. That wouldn't have met with the Lord's approval. So, Scott's point earlier in Hebrews 11, we do see Jephthah listed. We do see Jephthah listed in the text along with Gideon and Samson and Barak. David's listed there as a list of faithful servants, but that doesn't mean sinless. What was David's big sin? Bathsheba. Well, that's not commendable either. Well, murder too. That's a good point, Brother Lambert. So, just because he's there doesn't mean that, well, he couldn't have offered her as an offering, because if he did, then he wouldn't be listed in that chapter. No, that's arguing from silence, if you will. But some do look at that statement. So here's some of the things we can think about. In Leviticus 5, the law made provisions for rash vows. Now, rash, that's my term, a rash vow. You can look that passage up. If one realized that he could not keep such a vow, then other arrangements could be made. My question is, would you categorize Jephthah's vow as rash? That's an opinion question. You can answer the way that you want to think about it. That doesn't call it that in the Scripture. But for him to say that, not knowing what's going to come out of his house when he makes that promise or that vow, I think that's rash. That's not thinking. But that's, I think, worthy to be thought about. Here's one thing I think we can say for certain. We can say this. If Jephthah actually sacrificed his daughter as a burnt offering, he committed a great sin if he did that. That would not have been commendable behavior, and God would not have been pleased with that if he did. And no vow should be kept if the keeping of that vow results in a greater sin than the breaking of that vow. Would you agree with that? I would. If keeping the vow results in a greater sin than in breaking the vow, then what side should one err on? Well, okay, two wrongs don't make a right. So again, okay, we're not going to be able to decide did he or did he not. If someone says, well, I believe he offered her as an offering, just not as a burnt offering, but he vowed a burnt offering. That was the vow. And those who take the yes position, if they base their statement basically on verse 39, when it says he did to her according to as he vowed, then they're stuck with the burnt offering. Well, I understand, but if you're going to hang your hat on verse 39, then it's a burnt offering. I have a hard time believing that he did. I just can't see him doing that and God being pleased with that. I just can't see that. But I can't say for certain. I just have doubts in my mind about that. And I don't have to know. Just 1 second. Go ahead.
Think about a burnt offering. The entire thing is yes. Dedicated to God.
Yes. Could be.
Jephthah giving his daughter, not being able to have any descendants after him.
Yes. The end of verse 39 seems, that's a unique statement. They're talking about this keeping the vow, and then the writer just says, just sort of as a separate comment, and she had no relations with the man. Now, why put that in there? If she's offered up in the fire as a burnt offering, what would that have to do with her being offered as an offering? That seems to have some significance, I think, to what actually happened to her. So thus it became a custom in Israel. All right, you can give this some more thought. Again, as you were no doubt well aware, we could not solve that great mystery. But again, brethren are divided on that. Some say yes, some say no. Yes, sir. Yes. He made a promise. He made a vow, and vows should be paid. But again, did he actually offer her up on the altar as a burnt offering, which animals were consumed whole or totally in the fire? I just can't see him doing that. I just can't say. The animal wasn't the throat first slit, and then the... So what, he had killed his daughter first and then offered her? I can't see that either. That's a hard one for me to swallow. Okay, well, that can be another discussion. Thanks for your participation.